I spent today changing a lot of plans, but the one thing that I was going to absolutely do was show up here. And so I was sent by the secretary of the group a map telling me how to get here and a letter telling me how the meeting runs and every imaginable fact that I needed to get from Berkeley to here. And I was halfway across the bridge before I realized I, of course, left that behind me. And I figured, well, let's not cause that to have a stop, you know, a simple thing like directions. And showed up here. That's very spooky. I have never been in San Mateo. I have never been here before. You know, I think I spoke in San Mateo a while ago, but I never know where anything is. It's either Los Angeles or Mendocino or someplace in between. And I get real vague on a lot of details, like how you get anywhere. But here we are. That scares me because it indicates that a higher power works. It does. I don't worry about very much as I get to an AA meeting. I know I will not get a speeding ticket, although that did happen once. But, you know, most of the time I won't get a speeding ticket. The car will not explode. I will not have a flat tire. It's getting home again that's weird. But getting to it is fine. Anyway, as Bob mentioned, when you've been sober for longer than a week, you meet people who remember who you are. And you remember them. You know, that is one of the most startling things to me probably in this program. I've spent the vast majority of my life feeling isolated, unique, cut off, different from, apart. And to travel around and have people look at me and say, "Tom, when did you shave?" scares me. Because it indicates that there wasn't all that much brain damage after all. You know, if they remember that I shaved, they'll remember what I said. And if they remember what I said, I better not lie. So consequently, what I'm going to try to do for the next while is talk for about 45 minutes about my favorite subject, which is me. And try not to lie. If you see me suddenly get real vague, you'll know the tension that's going on. It's a wonderful story, Tom, but it's not true. That kind of thing. So consequently, what I get to talk about is what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I have a problem in doing some of this because I can get real theoretical. What is the meaning of meaning? You know, what is the real definition of the honest alcoholic? Final answers on what causes alcoholism, and is there an invisible line, or are you born alcoholic, or is it because your Uncle Harry drank a little too much vanilla extract? All those questions that really don't have anything to do with why I'm here. You know? And I found that the vaguer and more theoretical I get about my alcoholism, the closer I am to taking a drink. I have to get real practical and real simple about why I'm here. And I'm here tonight because I don't want to drink. And I'll tell you, just between you and me, I don't know why I am an alcoholic. I had a lot of good reasons to drink, but then we all did. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I know that I am an alcoholic. And as far as that cacophony of sound that goes on in my brain, that's the only answer I really need today. I started drinking when I was young enough to think that mixing bourbon and Hershey syrup was a good idea. I got real defensive about that a couple of years ago because I would say that and people would look, "Oh, how disgusting." Well, I would venture to say that most of you have drunk worse. judge not. You're not. I was going to try a line like, "Well, don't knock it until you try it," but I'm not going to do that in a room like this. I'll tell you, I loved it. That indicates I was real small. We always had alcohol around the house. Neither one of my parents, as far as I know, is alcoholic. They're social drinkers. It stuns me. There is a little alcoholism in the family, understatement. We were into being nice, and we're a very nice bunch of people. And if we had any virtue, it was we learned how to be polite, and we can be incredibly angry at someone and polite them to death. That's how we approached it. And in our family, I mean, it's part of, you know, it's Irish Catholic on my father's side and Swedish Lutheran on my mother's side, and that introduces a whole new definition of the word guilt, if you want to, you know, deal with that. You know, you think the Irish Catholics are guilty till you talk to the Swedish Lutherans, and then you discover that the Irish Catholics are mere beginners as far as real guilt goes. Anyway, for all the Andersons in the room, you understand. What's true about anything I'm going to say? Oh, polite was the virtue, you know. So we never talked about impolite things. We never talked about sex, ever. I think I was about 12 when I first heard the word pregnant. You know, and I ran to the dictionary, of course, alone, and when everyone else left the room, and looked it up, you know, and felt dirty. You know, wow, I know what pregnant means. Well, the way we dealt with alcoholism was exactly the same. I never heard anyone in my family ever use the word alcoholic, and that's because we had a little dose of alcoholism on both sides of the family. Every other first cousin on the Swedish side is a raving alcoholic. My grandmother drank herself to death. The way they refer to that in the old country is she was nervous for about 15 years. You know. And, you know, all this other kind of thing. Cover up, deny. It sounds like Washington, D.C., you know, as far as my family goes. And for us, alcoholism was like having a rhinoceros in the living room. Everybody knew that the rhinoceros was there. But the clear understanding is that whoever says we have a rhinoceros in the living room has to take the rhinoceros out. And we were just going to pretend it wasn't there. It was a lot safer. So what you do is that when the rhinoceros got real rambunctious and came roaring through smashing things, the prayer was, maybe he'll stop. And if he stops, I hope it's not on me, you know, and that kind of thing. We became real good at denial as a life cycle, and this is even including, you know, those in the family that aren't alcoholics. We deny the uncomfortable. That's my favorite trick to deal with anything that confuses me or hurts me or makes me uncomfortable today. I'll pretend it's not there. And I'll pretend it's not there until the pain becomes excruciating, and then I'll work a step. Most of my drinking was pretty boring. I know that's a big disappointment. If it's a disappointment to you, imagine what a disappointment it was for me. I heard an awful lot of, see, I shouldn't be here. You know, I don't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't do half the stuff that most of you other folks chat about over coffee, you know, and I wanted to, but I could just never concentrate that long when I was drinking to do it. I would hear what I refer to as the kind of AA macho. You know, I drank longer than you did, I drank worse than you did, I threw up more than you did, that kind of qualification for the program. And I was real impressed by some of the folks. And when I did my fourth and fifth step, which is that fearless and complete moral inventory, and sharing that with someone, I discovered that most of my drinking was boring, and when I drank, I got real bored, and I became a source of boredom for others. That's clear. Most of my drinking was depressive. For the vast majority of my drinking years, I was depressed. I didn't understand what depression was, you know. I mean, I have seen, I think, 5 therapists, most of them for depression, being unable to leave the room, being unable to talk, being unable to feel much of anything. I spent most of my drinking life numb, emotionally. Depression. With me, depression wasn't like, gee, I think I'm having a bad day. With me, I think in pictures, so if, you know, you're more logical, please try to follow, but But what I would do is I would see my emotional life was a roller coaster. I knew that before I came in these doors. And I would see there'd be highs and lows. And I would feel I could feel all of a sudden at 10 o'clock in the morning, I would feel the roller coaster go over the summit. And I would know that I was started on a time of depression. I knew also there was nothing I could do about it. This was an experience of raw powerlessness. And my prayer was that it wouldn't last longer than 3 months. After about 3 months depressed, I would try to do something to shake the depression. But I mean, all of that stuff that's connected with it was there. My senior year of college, which was in 1971, I was depressed the entire year. I was fine as long as I kept moving. As soon as I stopped moving, I burst into tears. That's an exaggeration, but not that much of an exaggeration. Suicide, if I could get up enough energy, seemed like a viable option. At least it was a real question for me. I started to see a psychiatrist for depression. He gave me tests and so forth and asked, gee, do you drink much? I said, an occasional social drink. And so we didn't talk about that, and I'm glad he didn't ask about DOPE because I didn't want to talk about that. And so we talked about my mother for the next 6 months and decided that the reason I was depressed was because I was living in Spokane, Washington. If you've ever been to Spokane, that's a pretty convincing statement. I mean, you drive over it and get depressed. So I left Spokane and felt a lot better right away. This is called doing a geographic. But the depression hit again. And again, it was this kind of thing. I've always had tremendous energy. And what I would do is go through incredible cycles. I still do this. But it's the cycle of going at 90 miles an hour or catatonic. Either I'll be doing the work of three people or I can't quite get the mail to the post office. There was very little room in between, and the scared people I lived with, I mean, they would notice these kinds of things. In fact, when I would be down, just the helplessness of that and the obviousness of it was just, and I figured this was just going to go on forever. And the one friend I had in those down times was alcohol. It was the one thing that numbed the pain, and it was the one thing that enabled me to kind of cope. Now, I was sober a year before someone explained to me the law of cause and effect. The law of cause and effect says certain causes bring about certain effects. That's the law. Practically put, it means that if you take depressants, alcohol, and marijuana, and consume large numbers of them every day for years, you will get depressed. I mean, that's the ironclad law, and I never figured that out. I was depressed for a lot of other reasons, not booze. Booze was my friend. So depression was a major thing. I mentioned the going 90 miles an hour. I had all the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality changes, especially towards the end. I had a lot of blackouts, but those are private affairs, you know. I would change the furniture in my room at 2 in the afternoon, go out for a few social drinks, come back, fall over the furniture and break a rib. But, you know, that's not real dramatic either. In my, again, fourth and fifth step, I never robbed a bank. I never mugged anybody. Never even got a drunk driving ticket. I mean, this stuns me. Since being sober, I have been given a very serious warning from the state of California about my driving sober. But when I was drinking, I drove very carefully. I didn't know what a 502 was. I thought it was, you know, the time of some meeting somewhere. 502, like the 12:15, you know. I never associated that with a drunk driving ticket until 6 months after I was in here. I asked someone, what's a 502? It seems like everyone's going to the 502, you know. And they looked at me funny, they felt sorry for me, didn't throw me out. But, I mean, I didn't know that stuff. I never spent a night in jail. I was chaplain at San Quentin for about 2 months, but that doesn't count. I mean, I get to leave, you know. I never even got a tattoo. I was hospitalized for a slight drinking problem a few years back, and I was the only person, men and women in this particular ward, I was the only person there without a tattoo, and I just felt so much like I didn't belong, you know. I pretended and drew, but it didn't count, you know, anyway. So I shouldn't be here. My drinking career was characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like other people. Countless vain attempts. I thought drinking was my right. I surely defended it. And when I had to make unfortunate choices between my friends and drinking, it was a pretty easy choice. You know, I chose drinking, and I chose it consistently. Anyway, what else can I tell you about this? I was not a non-functional drunk. I want to point that out. I was a full-time student. So, you know, same difference. But no, I really was. I was carrying down a full load of classes. I was president of my class. I was on the faculty senate. I was in my second year of studying theology in preparation for the priesthood in the Catholic Church. I had just finished a degree to become a credentialed lifetime teacher in the state of California on a secondary level. I did a lot of stuff. Bummed. Just bummed. But I functioned up until the last couple of months when I couldn't leave my room. I ended my drinking in August of 1976 in the People's Republic of Berkeley, where I had spent 2 years drinking and using a little social dope. And August in Berkeley is not a real cold time of the year, but I was so cold. I can remember a few sensations. Number one, the chill. I wore a lot of clothes because my hands and feet were always cold, and I kept on having to get circulation going to my fingers. People stare at you when you do that in August in Berkeley, but you know, you just take your place in line for odd things happening there. I lived in an apartment, and I spent my last drinking time sitting on the floor because you can't fall that easily. You can still fall, though. I want to appreciate you know that. And I sat between my bed and my desk with the heat on full blast, and I was reading a book at the time entitled I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. Now, if you ever had the good fortune, it's a fine book. And the book is about a young woman who is absolutely bonkers. And for her, the question was not suicide or going on another day, and that really wasn't my question either at the time. The question was, do you flip out or do you stay on Earth? And she was coming to a part, and I can remember somewhere in the book a very clear paragraph, as I am quietly drinking gin out of the coffee cup so no one will know I am drinking, where she says that she has a choice for sanity or not. A choice for sanity or not. And the reason that struck me so clearly is because I knew that I had that choice too. And insanity looked pretty attractive to me, just to be found in my room rocking back and forth. Seemed like a real nice way out. Because if you've been rocking back and forth for a couple of days, they'll just quietly take you away to a place where they'll take you for walks and feed you. And at the time, that looked real attractive. Like I say, I was a little depressed. What else is true? I had the curtains pulled, and the windows, of course, locked. The reason I had the curtains pulled is because they were out there. Whom, you might ask, are they? They are the same ones who listened in on the phones. Okay. Voices of recognition there. Yeah, you know them too. They would also follow me across campus. Not always and never during the daytime. But regularly after a couple of social drinks, you know, somewhere around 11 o'clock at night, they'd be there. They would also, they'd ride in the back seat of the car on Highway 17 between Berkeley and the Oakland Airport, usually after 11 o'clock at night after a couple of social drinks. And I'd be alone in the car, and I'd know they were there because I could hear them, and I would flash the mirror to catch it, and they'd duck. But they were there. That's who they are. I was drinking gin out of a coffee cup at the time because, as I told you, I didn't want anyone to know I was drinking. My last year or so of drinking, I kept falling down. My knees kept giving way for some reason. And I had a close encounter of the third kind with the Berkeley Police Department one evening, one moonlit evening, one full moonlit evening, I believe. And it was, you have to be going out of your way to be stopped by the Berkeley Police Department. And I had become Mr. Hyde just a few minutes before, and I was screaming on Telegraph Avenue, you know, again, standing in, you have to stand in line to scream on Telegraph Avenue. Standing in line, screaming on about killing someone or other who happened to be my superior. Well, I was doing it convincingly enough where they thought they'd stop and chat. And I had someone with me who said, listen, he's just real drunk and we'll get him home. And 4 hours later, they got me home. And I didn't live that far. It was just across campus. But I had to lecture trees and I wanted to streak and do all kinds of socially unacceptable behavior. The next morning, I came to knowing I had a four-hour blackout. And I called my friend, who was also in the order with me, and I asked him, what happened last night? Now, I had been asking that question for some years. And for the first 5 or 6 or 7 years, all the folks I lived with thought I was lying. Now, see, I've never been married that I remember, but I have lived with other folks, other members of my religious community for like the past 16 years, is that possible? So I've never hidden my drinking from wife, lover, weekend roommate, but I have hidden my drinking from 23 other people all the time. So they noticed the pattern, and I, for the first few years, they thought I was lying when I said, I really don't remember what happened. Well, to my horror, a couple of these people reached the conclusion that I was an alcoholic and started going to Al-Anon. They learn things in Al-Anon. And one of the things they learn in Al-Anon is not to accuse or yell or scream or make the alcoholic feel guilty, but do manage to tell the truth. So I called Jerry on the phone and said, how are you? What's new? I don't remember much of last night. What happened? And I was hoping he'd say something like, Tom, you made an ass out of yourself again, period, and go home. He said, why don't you drop by and we'll talk about it? And so I did. And by the time I got to him, I was terrified. And he didn't accuse, yell, scream, or shout. He just said, at 8:13, you started doing this. At 8:20, this was happening. At 9 o'clock, the police got by. At 9:15, this happened. At 10, that's right. That, like he was taking notes. Now, he ended this whole thing, and when he ended, I was scared to death. And I was scared to death about two different things. Number one, it was obvious that my drinking was way out of control. And during those times of blackouts, I was real self-destructive, real destructive, real ugly, really hideous. I'm the original peace, love, and joy candidate of why don't we all get along and just share as persons, you know? And I'm reaching for an axe after a couple of social drinks. This is not fun behavior. So that was number one that scared me. Number two, and this scared me even more, is I did this in front of witnesses. And I reached a conclusion there. Number one was I was never going to drink again, you know. And number two is when I started to drink again, I was going to do it alone. And I went for about 3 months without a drink, and that was the worst time, I think, of my entire life. It was during that time I was chaplain at San Quentin, an assistant chaplain at San Quentin, And that's what I did for those 3 months. I didn't drink. And that's all I did. That was my absolute obsession. I was obsessed with alcohol, even when I wasn't drinking it. If you asked me at 1 p.m, Tom, what are you doing today? My honest answer was, I'm not drinking. If you asked me at 8 p.m, Tom, how was your day? I would tell you, I haven't had a drink. And I would wait up every night until midnight, having a little bit of drama in my background, and cross another goddamn day of hell. And sigh a lot. I sighed a lot for those 3 months because I was doomed. I mean, I knew I was doomed, and I knew a couple of things else that were also very true for me, one of which was that this wasn't going to last. See, I have always mixed up not drinking with being good. And I'm someone who can only be good for so long. Every day I'm good, 5 pounds get added to my shoulders. I'm a strong man. 20 pounds, I don't notice. 50, I start paying attention to. And in my cunning, baffling, and powerful mind, I'll rush into the future and say, you know, today is pretty grim with this 75 pounds on my shoulder. By next month, it'll be 7,000 pounds, and I won't be able to move, so I better have something to drink and start over again. See, because once I have a drink and I'm bad, I can start over again fresh, you know? And that was kind of my basic drinking pattern during that time. I couldn't stand the great virtue of not drinking. The liberating news of this program is that alcoholism is not a moral issue. It has nothing to do with being good or bad. I mean, you know, it just doesn't. And for me, those are very freeing words and very liberating words. I mean, I'm sober, not canonized. There's a big difference. Although in some meetings you wouldn't know that. You know, folks get a little mixed up. I haven't had a drink in 7 days. Let me give you advice. You know, that happens. And avoid those people. They're crazy. Anyway, I started drinking again. And I started drinking again because I didn't know what else to do. And I tried drinking on the sly, and I tried trying to drink hidden, and I tried doing all, but you know, it just doesn't work. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Not happy, but I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was confronted by superiors and everyone from just this side of the Pope. And I was told I was going to be hospitalized, and that was not happy news to me. Now, if there are any folks in the room who have had the experience very recently of being told that they're going to be gotten sober, listen, I know you don't feel real happy to be here tonight, and it's okay. It's okay. I didn't. See, stopping drinking for me was not just stopping drinking. That's easy. Anybody can do that. I just couldn't stay stopped. And for me, I mean, what did alcohol do for me? Alcohol worked for me. When I drank, and this is like from time 13 years and up, and probably even a little earlier than that, but, you know, adolescent, all those wonderful days of being a teenager. God. Couple of social drinks and my voice got deeper. And I put on about 20 pounds, got taller, got a lot of confidence. I could talk to women, you know. And by women, I'm talking about 13-year-old girls with braces, you know. But women, you know, talk to them. I could dance real good. The first time I ever danced sober in my life, I was 30 years old at the Monterey Young People's Conference, and there's a whole new sense of balance sober that I never knew about when I was drinking. What else is true there? Yeah, out of a bottle, I got sophistication, and I got masculinity, and I got manhood and intelligence. Alcohol to me was my best friend and my most constant lover. And so when they were going to take away my bottle, like any 3-year-old would say, you know, they just weren't turning off bourbon. They were taking away from me my intelligence, my sophistication, my manhood, my maturity, my best friend, and my most constant lover. I didn't feel real good when I came into these rooms. And the first meeting I went to was in Oakland at 2910 Telegraph, which is still one of my favorite hangouts, and it was an old-timers meeting. Oy. I mean, listen, I'm too young to be an alcoholic, which is another reason I don't belong here. I was convinced that at the age of 29, I was the youngest person in the history of the world that had to get sober. And I wasn't real happy about that either. I thought it was unfair. I mean, what got me most of all was how unfair it was. Because if the world was fair, I'd be able to drink until I was 65 like everybody else. Cut off in my prime. And I walked up to this meeting, and there were all these folks in there, about 12 or 15 of them. In Alameda County, we don't have a lot of speakers' meetings because we think that smacks of monarchy. We like the kind of group, you know? And the guy who was the chair, I think his name was Tom, too, but, I mean, he was just this side of 10,000 years old, and everyone else in the room, you know, again, the tattoos and short hair, and they were wearing socks and polyester and that. That meeting smoked Marlboro Box as part of group identity, you know, and he started off by saying, well, y'all know my story, so I'm not going to bore you with it anymore. And, you know, they all laughed and he laughed. I didn't know his story. Now, this led me to conclude that I was wrong, because I didn't know his story if I had only shown up last week, you know. So it was real, you know, welcome him. I just sat there and grinned terrified. The next person talked about getting up enough energy to cut the front lawn this week. It was a real good week. Now, I wasn't real impressed by that. Nor did I have a front lawn. Okay. There was a married couple there, heterosexual, who were married to each other and talking to each other and enjoyed each other's company. And that kind of takes you back. You know, you say, I thought the Waltons were dead. You know, you're there. Then it was my turn. What do you say? You know, not feeling real good about being alive to start with and afraid they'll throw you out because you aren't in real good shape. This is a Friday night meeting, and my last drink was Tuesday night, and this is real embarrassing, and I've only mentioned this in a couple of other meetings, and if you quote me, I'll deny it. My last drink was beer, and I didn't even get drunk, and it was in a pizza parlor, and it was like about a pitcher or two of beer. If I had known that was my last drink. Like I say, there I was, cut off in my prime. So I said, my name was Tom and I'm an alcoholic. And they all said, hi, Tom. Looked like the Rocky Horror Picture Show to me, if you ever seen that. Shouted right back. And I said, my last drinking was Tuesday night. And when I said my last drinking was Tuesday night, of course I didn't tell him it was beer, this group of ancient, broken down, short-haired, gray-haired, polyestered, socked, tattooed, clean-shaven bunch of women and men with whom I had nothing in common burst into applause. And that never happened to me before. And I had some real good friends. And they were real concerned about me.
Drove them to Al-Anon, that's concern or rage, you know.
And when they'd say, Tom, how you doing? And I'd say, I haven't had a drink in 3 days. They didn't clap. They'd look kind of embarrassed, you know. Like, oh.
who's playing tonight? You know, Dodgers? They would say things like, so? This group of women and men burst into applause because they knew what it meant to not have a drink since Tuesday night. And I never met anybody like that before. And that's when I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the first time in a long time that I felt some hope, and I felt some thrills, and I found... Ernest Hemingway has a short story, and it's called A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. If you've ever read it, you'll understand what I'm talking about. And he talks about a place in the world where it's safe. Because out there, it's real grim. But in a clean, well-lighted place, you could come and just be. And when I read that story in my senior year of college during my first romp with the doctor, I knew what he was talking about, and I spent a lot of years looking for clean, well-lighted places, and I found him that night in Alcoholics Anonymous. So not all of our places are that well-lit, and not all of our places are that clean. But the idea is there, the safety. The advice I got at that meeting was to go to lots of meetings. My social calendar wasn't real full. I found that television, I couldn't watch a lot of television and not drink. I don't know whether that's been your experience. It's real hard to watch the tube straight. Still is for me. And a lot of it's the advertising. I mean, to suddenly discover it 3 years sober that weekends were made for Michelob gets me a little angry sometimes, and I overreact and imply that their parents weren't married, and so I don't watch that much of it. The second piece of advice I got there from the same man, we go to lots of meetings, don't drink in between meetings. And I didn't know that. I didn't know how you people didn't drink. I really didn't. I mean, I would do it for 3 months at a time. Or the rest of my life. Or till Tuesday night. You know, stuff. But in between meetings, what occurred to me real fast was that if I went to lots of meetings, it'd be easier to not drink. And I am real grateful that no one told me we do it here a day at a time. Because my experience with the 24-hour period was the first couple of hours went by real fast, and then the day started slowing down. Because I never drank in the morning, which is another reason I shouldn't be here. You know, I didn't know you could. My drinking started with beer in the afternoon, and beer isn't alcohol anyway, and it got to wine, which is a little more respectable. But my day would usually start around 9 o'clock at night. And between 9 o'clock at night and when the bars closed down or when I was done, and that isn't always the same event, that was my day. So I could get through till 3 in the afternoon with no hassle. 5 gets a little rough. By 7 and 9, I couldn't have stood a day at a time. In between meetings, though, meant that if I went to a meeting tonight at 8:30 and got out at 10, all I had to do was make it through to 8:30 tomorrow night, which is less than 24 hours, and I could do that, and I did that for a year. And when the meetings closed, I didn't understand about phone numbers. My vocabulary had gotten a little reduced in the last bit of my drinking, and I used a lot of biological terms. But I found it real hard to talk to anybody about emotions. I didn't know what emotion... I hadn't felt an honest emotion in 10 years. How do I talk about that? How do I tell someone that I'm scared to death? How do I tell another man that the fact that he's in the room makes me feel safer? That was the man I asked to be my sponsor 6 months sober, but I didn't tell him he made me feel safer, you know? How do you communicate about anything? How do you go out for coffee afterwards? I couldn't have stood it. So what I did after the meetings is if the compulsion to drink was on me, and it stayed for a while. The compulsion in my mind was like I was metal and bars were magnets. And the magnets got turned on. Erratically, you know, 11:30 at night, boom, the magnet's on, I'm out of bed. And as long as that magnet was on, I'd put on a pair of wooden shoes,
And on the Cal campus in Berkeley, we have very tall buildings and cobblestones, and if you stamp real loud with wooden shoes, it echoes. Excuse me, and you can scream lots of things that are kind of vulgar, and no one really minds. And so what I did every night for about 3 to 6 months when that magnet went on is I went out there and put on those wooden shoes and screamed and shouted in between the buildings until 2 a.m. when the magnet turned off. Boom. My compulsion to drink was to go into bars. It never occurred to me to take a bottle to my room, and I'm very thankful for that amount of ignorance. So, go to lots of meetings, don't drink in between meetings, and the third piece of advice was, and we don't take no dope. I didn't know that either. See, I had been smoking non-habit-forming marijuana every day for 7 years. And I especially smoked it when I wasn't drinking. How else do you not drink? I mean, I couldn't imagine. I can remember standing on the roof of a university not far from here. I was just sent into the hospital to dry out. And I was up there with a pipe with this non-habit-forming stuff in it, and I was just this side of Pluto. And I stared out at the Santa Clara Valley feeling very sorry for myself because I couldn't drink anymore because they were taking away my bottle. And I said, how could all this exist without me? The answer is very easily, you know, very easily, a little ego deflation and even dope gets taken away. And suddenly to be standing there without all those wonderful helps was real scary. My first year sober, I stayed in Berkeley. I finished my theological studies. I went to a tremendous amount of meetings. The men with whom I lived were so thrilled to see me sober that they told me that should I want to be ordained a priest, and I still wanted to be ordained a priest after a year's sobriety, they'd be thrilled to do it. Well, I started making a decision. Oy, oy, you know, what do I want to be when I grew up? What do I feel? What do I think about anything? Am I an atheist? Am I an axe murderer? Am I a this? Am I a that? What do I want? All those questions went on for pretty much a year. And at the end of that year, I felt free enough to make a decision. And the freedom was in this. I knew that if I stayed in the order and went to lots of meetings, didn't drink in between meetings, and didn't use no dope, my life would be fine. And I knew that if I left the order and went to lots of meetings, didn't drink in between meetings, and didn't use no dope, my life would be fine. And for the first time in my life at the age of 30, I made a free choice. I decided, let's give it a try one day at a time. And it's been the most amazing ride. I taught for 4 years in Los Angeles, 17-year-old boys, and I did not drink, and that is a miracle. You never know where a 17-year-old has been, for those of you who have had any dealings with them. Don't touch them. And I got real active in the program down there, and I talked to folks and did stuff with folks, and then I've been reassigned up here to work in Alameda County in the last while. So I've been back here for a year. I have just celebrated my 6th birthday without a drink, or a joint, or a pill. And I'm stunned by that, you know? Stunned, I mean, that's nice. What stuns me is that it's almost 9:30 and I'm not loaded on a Saturday night. That's what stuns me. Because, I mean, I had a couple of wonderful advisors and counselors and people who love me as I trudged this happy road. And one of them, as I began living a sober life, I didn't know how to start. I was given advice. Eat regularly. If you want to stay sober, Tom, eat regularly. That was a revolutionary thought to me. Sleep 6 to 8 hours a night. Sleep. Buy new clothes. Get a haircut. Brush your teeth. Take yourself out for lunch now and again. You're sober. Wash. take showers. Use soap. Now, I'll tell you, that's my program. I just get real nervous around the real theoretical. You know, when folks at the meetings start talking about the music of the spheres, I find a new meeting. I find one where they talk about not drinking today and use soap and try to get some food down and don't commit suicide or homicide till tomorrow, you know. Real practical stuff, because I need that real practical stuff. And a man, I went into therapy when I was 3 months sober in a very helpful therapeutic relationship with a psychologist in Berkeley. And at one point I was, because he helped me name feelings, and that was my problem. Feeling anything was a problem for me. How do you feel? How do you know what you feel? I'm feeling something. Is it joy or fear? I don't know. All I know is I'm feeling something. Alcohol. Let me tell you about Leonard. Leonard was a therapist that I was involved in, and I went in to see him, and I was feeling really bad. I'm feeling, that's it. Yeah, you know, how do you... So he helped me name these things. He helped me make sense out of a lot of this. And at one point I said, Leonard, how do I know I'm normal? You know, which was my question for years. And his response was, normal is 98.6. Other than that, it doesn't have a lot of meaning, you know, and it really doesn't. But then he said, looking very wise, he said, are you really asking how do you know you're a healthy person? I said, yeah. See, I mean, I didn't know the questions to ask. You know, like, I would go in and say, what am I feeling? I mean, that was my question. You know, you have to ask things, you know, identify. Are you in pain? What's pain? Anyway, what Leonard said is that when Freud was an old man, Freud came up with the definition of a healthy person, which was kind of useful for a long time. And that definition was that a healthy person is a person who can work and who can love. And then Leonard said, but you know, we know that's not enough. What we think a healthy person is these days is a person who can work, a person who can love, and a person who can play. If you can work and love and play, you're a pretty healthy person. And he said, but your alcoholism did to you, Tom, when you were out there having a few social drinks by yourself in your room. You became incapable of working. You couldn't leave your room. You couldn't read. You couldn't write. I couldn't write. Love? When was the last time you trusted anybody, Tom? I mean, really trusted somebody. When was the last time you felt comfortable around somebody? When was the last time that you could just be friends? And as far as play went, he said, Tom, when was the last time you did something you enjoyed? It had been a long time. He'd ask me questions like, what do you really like to do? And I says, I just love music. And he says, when was the last time you were at a concert? Huh? See, to go to a concert, I would have had to leave my room. You like museums? Love them. When was the last time you were at one? You like to cook? Yeah, I really do. When was the last time you were in a kitchen without drinking? Huh? Do you like to go for walks? Do you like to swim? Do you like to read books? Do you like to run? Do you like to learn other languages? Do you like to make model planes? Tom, what do you like to do? And I didn't know. So he said, Tom, you have my permission to learn how to play for the rest of your life. And so that's what I do. I find out, I mean, I'm a running laboratory. I find out I can work and I don't even have to like it. I can still show up. I can love. Now, I'll tell you something about love. And this is not, you know, deep passion, relationship, meeting time, you know. My relationship doesn't care. That kind of stuff. I don't understand. What I discovered about love is that no one does it real well. You're not the only one who's having difficulty in the relationship area, just between you and me. How do you just be friends? How do you just be friends with someone? We're all very clumsy at it. But we're capable of learning, and that's wonderful. And as far as play goes, finding out how to play, finding out how to laugh. When I came into this fellowship, I thought I'd never laugh again. I never thought I'd work again. And I was convinced I could never trust any of you. But since coming here, on a regular basis for a while, I've learned how to work, how to love, and how to play by going to lots of meetings, not drinking in between meetings, and not using no dope. And I've learned that in rooms like this from people like you, and that's why I love you. Thank you.